today we have the a visitor of Tlan, the first visitor after or one of the first visitors after the pandemic stop. Ian is an associate professor at Stony Brook, specialist on physics of on galactic scales. I feel, Dean, I'm sorry to find your CV on your web page.
It's already 10 years old.
But yeah, I need to introduce yourself. Usually, as you know, we introduce the speaker, and then you can start when you want to present your seminar on star formation and the mass function in outskirts of nearby galaxies. Thank you. I invite all people to ask at any time, and do not hesitate to show your face using the webcam. Okay. Thank you, Ian.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much for the introduction. And yeah, I was asked to give this talk, take this route 2 months ago, and I've been thinking what I want to present. I work on many different things, too many that it's even confused myself. But for today, I picked up this topic, star formation and the initial mass function, so the mode of star formation in the outskirts of nearby galaxies. Can you hear me okay?
Perfectly.
Yeah, good. Yes. So yeah, I've been visiting LAM since the beginning of October for 2 months, and time really flies. So my 2 months is going to be over next week. So next Tuesday, I am flying back to New York. To my own institution, but I still have time here this week and Monday. If you have any questions or if you feel like chatting with anybody to take a rest for a coffee, please knock my door. I'm in the third floor of LAM. Since I've been here for 2 months, I feel like part of the family, if I'm allowed to feel in that way. So I want to give this talk somewhat a casual way, and I want you to feel, you know, easy to ask questions at any time. So please feel free to stop me, ask questions. Okay. Okay. Yeah, so the outline of this talk, so I'm going to tell you about the initial max function in the outskirts of galaxies, nearby galaxies, and in this particular case, the extended ultraviolet disks of nearby galaxies. And if I have time, I want to show off some recent CO detection in the XUV disk of M83. This is something that people have been working on without success. And I'm quite excited that we are now detecting a bunch of COs, molecular clouds, in the XUV disk of M83. I'm not sure if I have time, but if I have time, I want to show off some of the exciting results, which I don't have an interpretation yet. Okay, so start from the very basics. This talk is about the extended ultraviolet disks of nearby galaxies. And some of you, many of you probably know about this already. So XUV disk is the very extended disk around nearby normal galaxies, like Messier object, in this case, Messier 83, found by GalaxUV satellite. So the traditional optical size of M83 is within this yellow contour, which is roughly about R25. In radius. So that's the size of the galaxy in optical, right? But if you look at M83 with Galax, you start to find very extended blobs, UV structures. So these blue points are all ultraviolet emission coming from the extended disk component of the disk of M83. Red here is a contour of H1 atomic hydrogen emission. And most of these UV blobs, recent star formation, are enclosed in this extended H1 disk component. Galax did a survey, and about 20 to 30% of nearby disk galaxies have this spatially extended ultraviolet disk. We call it XUV disks, extended UV disk, XUV disks. I just want to show you a couple of examples. So here is an optical image of NGC 3198. And if you switch to Galax, then you know there's a huge extended UV emissions. So the visual impression, you know, change your view of galaxies. It doesn't, the disk doesn't end at the edge of the optical disk. It extends much beyond. Sometimes like twice or even five times larger than the optical disk. And these are UV emissions, so they should be coming from either O or B-type stars, OB-type stars. The question here is why we didn't know them before, because even in 20th century, there are a lot of H-alpha imaging of nearby galaxies. And if there are recent star formations, why we didn't detect them in H-alpha? So that has been the question. So this talk is about the mode of star formation. So as I said, the question is why we didn't see H-alpha emission before when it's bright in UV. More professionally, if I rephrase the question, it's about the mode of star formation or the initial mass function of the star formation in XUV disks. Or more specifically, there is a claim that if star formation rate is low, then you cannot form very massive stellar clusters. And if the mass of star cluster is low, then some people say you cannot form massive stars. So in the language of the initial mass function, it's truncated IMF at high mass end. You cannot form massive stars in low star formation rate environment. The other way to see it is if the star formation rate is low, then you can still apply the standard initial mass function, like Sarbita initial mass function, but the probability to fill high mass end of the mass function is very low. So in most cases, you don't see them, but it's not impossible to form massive stars. And that standard IMF is stochastic sampling model. So the question here is, you know, which one is correct? Okay. Of course, there are previous H-alpha imagings, many of them. And depending on the observations and analysis, the previous studies came up with different results. So some people say H-alpha emission is truncated near the edge of the optical disk. So you don't find H-alpha emissions beyond. That seems to indicate that truncated IMF is the one in the XUV disk. Some people say, well, there are H2 regions here and there occasionally. So it's a stochastic sampling type of IMF. You occasionally make massive stars, but the probability is low, so you don't see them as much. So here we want to constrain the high mass end of initial mass function by comparing UV and very deep H-alpha imaging with Subaru telescope. The idea, of course, is UV traces either B or O-type stars, and H-alpha is mostly from O-type stars, not from B stars. I have another slide to explain this. There is a very limited amount of spectroscopy, just a tiny region in XUV disk. Their metallicity is relatively low, like LMC or SMSC type of metallicity. Okay. And the extinction is not that significant. It's only 0.1 magnitude in V magnitude. Again, it's just a very limited sample, just a tiny, you know, one or two H2 regions, but that's the result we have at hand. So I said that H-alpha emission traces all stars, and we want to compare that with UV emission that traces O and B stars. And the ratio between the two gives us the initial mass function at high mass end. I want to show it in a quantitative way. So this is a table of single star based on model calculation. And here it's spectral type starting from O3 type all the way down to B0 or B0.5 type. So very early B type stars. And if you look at the amount of ionizing photons, so which is this red boxed column, you can see that the flux decreases significantly as you move down to B-type stars. And if you compare O3 star and B0 star, the amount of ionizing flux is 100 times smaller. And even if you compare the O8 type star and B0 star, so just a small span of mass in between, even then the flux changes by a factor of 10, so an order of magnitude. So that means that, you know, you really need all stars to make an H2 region. So if you find the H2 region, then you can immediately tell that there is an O-type stars. And that's why, you know, deep H alpha imaging is very important. One more thing I want to add, because you know, many people now talk about binary fraction of massive stars. When we talk about the initial mass function, galaxies, photometric evolution, many people ask, you know, what if there are binary massive stars? What if there is a spin in these stars? That seems to change the flux a little bit. But compared to this range, you know, two orders of magnitude or one order of magnitude, binarity doesn't really matter. Even if you have two B0 type stars, it doubles the flux, but not an order of magnitude. So now we want to find all stars. If you, based on this, if we find H2 regions, then we need at least one all stars. Even if you have two of them, it doesn't really matter. We count it as one H2 region. Good. So we did the survey, H alpha survey of 10 nearby XUV disks. And their distance is up to something like 10 megaparsecs. So it's very nearby galaxies. Subaru have relatively wide field camera. And that's why we can go deep in like 3-hour integration with H alpha per each galaxy. So here's an example, NGC 3198 in Galax. And this blue is roughly R25. And XUV disk, of course, extend beyond the optical radius. And if we see it in H with Subaru, here is the extent of the galaxy. So the even optical disk actually extend beyond R25 quite a bit. And the red, of course, is H alpha emission. We find a lot of H2 regions. We can, you know, visually identify them. And we can even see the shapes of H2 regions. And that's the power of deep imaging with 8-meter class telescope. So we want to test the high mass end of initial mass function. And here is the method. It's very simple. The idea is if we assume that stellar cluster formation is instantaneous, so all stars in individual cluster formed at the same time. So we can just use single stellar population to track the photometric evolution of clusters. And also across the XUV disk, the cluster formation rate was constant. And we are talking about high mass star formation, so we don't need to go back to the beginning of the universe. We are just talking about very recent span, short span of time. And within that short span of time, if cluster formation rate is constant, and then we can say this equation should hold. So what this means is the numerator of the left-hand side is the number of star clusters bright in H alpha. divided by the number of cluster bright in far UV, meaning that cluster which have O or B type stars, the numerator are clusters hosting O type stars, the ratio between the two. So that's initial mass function, right? And that should be equal to the ratio of the time scales. And we roughly know that the duration that clusters are bright in H alpha, that's basically the lifetime of all stars. So something like 10 million years. Denominator here is the duration that clusters are bright in FUV, which is basically the lifetime of all B stars, so something like 100 million years. So roughly, if we count the number of clusters bright in H alpha and bright in UV, then we, if the Sarepta initial mass function, the standard initial mass function is correct, then we should find something like 10%, rough guess. Or if the initial mass function is truncated, if massive stars cannot form in this environment, then the left-hand side and H alpha should be zero, right? So we should be able to differentiate the Sarepta, the standard initial mass function and truncated initial mass function. Good, make sense? So that's the idea, but quantifying it was very difficult. And we need quantitative definitions of bright in H alpha and bright in UV. When you count them, it's not just a vague concept. You really need to define it. So to define it, we looked at single stellar population synthesis model, and we just took Starburst 99 because it calculates, we can manipulate the initial mass function in Starburst 99. What we did was just take the standard IMF, in this case, Sarepta IMF, but we did test with other IMFs like Grupa, for example, and it doesn't really matter in the end. What we did was change the maximum stellar mass to mimic truncated IMF. So model one, we included stars up to 100 solar mass. So this cluster have all stars also. And also we set it to 20 solar mass, the maximum stellar mass to be 20 solar mass, meaning that you have up to B type stars, but no O stars. Or three solar mass, so you have up to A type stars, but no OB stars at all. With this, we get spectral energy distribution and we can calculate the number of ionizing photons for that SED. So we can convert that to H alpha line flux using KSP recommendation model. So we put that on top of SED and measured color in different band, R band, B band, FUV, near UV, and also narrow band, Subaru narrow band, including H alpha emission. We assumed 20% solar metallicity because that was the result from spectroscopic observation of very limited sample in these regions. So here's a result of model calculation, and the vertical axis is FUV minus NUV color as a function of time. And again, this is SSP model, single stellar population model representing a cluster. If you have completely filled IMF up to 100 solar mass star, then the cluster starts from very blue in FUV minus NUV color, and then gradually becomes redder and redder in this color definition. If you don't have all stars, so up to 20 solar mass in IMF, they roughly start from the same color as completely filled one. And they merge together around 10 million years because most of the all stars die by then. So their stellar population becomes the same. So their evolution becomes the same. But if you don't have either all star or B, so no OB stars up to three solar mass in the IMF, then you don't become, the clusters doesn't become blue in this color definition. They just stay red from the very beginning. So if you we set, for example, the FUV minus NUV color of zero magnitude and bluer as our selection criterion, then we can pick up clusters which have O and B, O or B stars, or O and B stars. And if you set the color criterion, and that gives us the time scale, which is 71 billion years. So remember that the number ratio equals the time scale ratio, that's the equation we want to use for the test. And we are setting color criterion to count the number of clusters blue in FUV minus NUV. And we are setting the time scale that clusters are blue or bright in UV. We do the same for Subaru narrow band minus R band color. Again, if you don't have OB stars, then they never become blue in this definition or HF are bright. So they stay around zero in color. If cluster have B type stars, then you get an excess H alpha emission on top of stellar continuum. So the cluster becomes blue in this definition up to negative one magnitude. And if you have all stars, then it even becomes a bluer, so negative two magnitude. So he wants to use H alpha emission to differentiate clusters with all stars and without all stars. We can set the threshold of negative one magnitude, and that gives us the time scale 5.8 million years. So now back to the test equation. We now have quantitative definition of clusters that we want to count. The number of clusters with this color less than negative one magnitude is the clusters we want to count. And the number of clusters with FUV minus NUV bluer than zero magnitude is the clusters we want to count. And the model gave us time scale. So the ratio of the two time scales is at about 8%. So if we start from FUV blocks, and count the number of them with H alpha, and he find 8% of them having H alpha, then the standard IMF is okay. So the idea is very simple. Here is a roadmap of what we need to do. Again, the idea was very simple, but we needed to go through several different details to count it right. So we run source extractor on FUV image of Galax and make a master catalog. And around each FUV, we measure H alpha and R band flux with Subaru images. And after that, we do a completeness check. And we need to do background subtraction because Galax images have a lot of background objects. So we need to remove them. And we need to think about extinction correction. So that's what I'm going to do. So this is an example of M83. Again, we observed 10 galaxies, but this is just one example, just to show how we did that. So this is M83, and yellow is roughly the optical disk, and red is H1 gas distribution. And image is Galax, and we find a lot of UV dots. And we identify this UV dot with source extractor and measure H alpha and R band flux or magnitude. Here is the color, narrow band minus R band, as a function of narrow band total magnitude. Dot is the data points, and lines are the evolution of single stellar population. This is 10 to the 2 solar mass cluster, 10 to the 3, and 10 to the 4 solar mass clusters. We set our thresholds to negative 1 magnitude in this color. here are 5 sigma and 3 sigma detection limit. And if you compare the two, you know, we immediately know that we are sensitive down to 100 solar mass cluster. So very small clusters we can detect. We do the same thing for galaxies. So this is far UV, NUV color as a function of FUV total magnitude of this object, apparent magnitude of these objects. And these are the evolutionary tracks, 10 to the 2 solar mass, 3 and 4. Our selection criteria is the color of 0 magnitude or bluer. If we compare that with the sensitivity cut, we are complete down to 10 to the 3 solar mass. But 10 to the 2 solar mass clusters, you know, we are not covering this region. That means it's not complete. So our analysis is limited down to 10 to the 3 solar mass, 100,000 solar mass cluster. We need to take into account the background contamination. So to check that, we separated the region between the area within H1 contour and outside. And here is a color plot, Subaru color, including H alpha and FUV minus NUV color. Dots are the data points. And I included clusters with the mass greater than 1,000 solar masses because that's the completeness limit. If you look at the data points inside H1 contour, where we find most of the UV blobs and H2 regions, we find excess here. But outside H1 contour, we don't find excess here. So excess here, you know, downward means, you know, H alpha bright. So basically, outside of H1 contour atomic gas distribution, there is no H2 region, no object having H2 region around. So we can just directly count the number of clusters with H2 region, H alpha emission in the data, and that's the number of clusters with H2 regions in MAD3 in this case. This is the same plot, and this line is model calculation, how cluster evolve with time. There is a shift between the model color and the data distribution. And since narrow band and R band are basically the same wavelengths, it does not suffer from the extinction. So there's no shift in the vertical direction. But FUV minus NUV color could be affected by extinction. And this is a vector of 0.1 magnitude in Navy. Now, if you compare this model curve and data point, there's roughly 0.1 magnitude shift overall. So we can make a correction for the extinction in this case, based on this. We need to subtract the background. And again, for H alpha, there's no background contamination. We already seen that, so that. In case of UV, we need to take into account the background. So here is a histogram of the color versus the number of UV blobs. And blue is outside H1 contour. And green is inside H1 contour. And if we make a correction of the area ratio between the two and subtract outside the population from inside the population, red is the color distribution of the clusters in MAD3. We can say that this part, red part, are mostly zero. So most of the red populations in galaxies are background object, and blue population belong to MAD3. And nicely, the AV of 0.1 magnitude from the previous plot we determined corresponds to something like 0.2 magnitude in FeV minus NeV color. And if we draw a line there, then we can include population in M83 nicely. So including extinction correction, we draw line selection line here, and everything on the left-hand side is the number of UV blobs. And again, the number of H-alpha bright objects, we can just count everything we detected, and we found it's 9, and these are the 9 objects. You can see structures, H2 regions around these objects. They are definitely H2 region in M83 XUV disk. So if we take the ratio, we can get 10% of FUV blobs having H2 regions, which is roughly consistent with 8% from model calculation. So it seems to mean that the standard IMF is just fine without truncation, even in this low star formation rate environment. Our detection limit was, completeness limit was down to 10 to the 3 solar mass from galaxy detection limit, but Subaru data covers even lower mass clusters. And we find very low mass clusters having H2 regions. So that means, even if you have, if you form very low mass clusters below 1,000 solar mass, let's say 500 solar mass clusters, or even 100 solar mass clusters, you can still form O-type stars, or you are still forming O-type stars. So even if you go to very low mass star clusters, you can still have massive stars, like O-type stars. So that seems to indicate that the IMF is not truncated, even in these extreme regions. You can form O-type stars, but they are stochastically filled. The probability to fill it is low, but you can still fill it. And you can see it, you have good statistics. I started from very simple idea, just the ratio of UV blob versus H-alpha blob should be roughly 10%. Because H-alpha lifetime, UV lifetime, 10 million year over 100 million year is 10%. And I tried to convince you by showing the detailed calculation and all the details that we have to think about. But we come back to the very basics, the visual inspection that already tells you the result I showed. So this is another Galaxy NZC 6628 Galaxy image. And to guide your eye, this is basically the R25 radius or diameter. And this magenta is H1 region, atomic gas distribution, roughly. And if you look at Subaru image, we see a lot of H2 regions. We can recognize them by eye. I zoom into one region, okay? So outside the optical radius and inside H1 gas, there are a lot of H2 regions. This is very extended, for example. And we detect 5UV bright blobs in this region, and this is the result from source extractor, everything above 5 sigma. And I circle, and this is a Subaru image with the same FUV circles or ellipse around. Many of them have H2 regions, right? So all type stars. And we impose the color selection criterion, FUV minus NUV zero, less than 0 magnitude, bluer than that, and those are yellows. And among those yellows, we also impose narrowband minus R, H alpha narrowband minus R band color less than -1 magnitude. And those are these white circles. Now, what is your impression? That like 10% of them having H2 regions or not? You can come back to this in the video and I just show you the result of the more detailed analysis of all galaxies. So we detected a few UV bright clusters in all galaxies and H alpha bright clusters in all galaxies. The total number is about 1,000 and about 100. The ratio between the two was 8%, the same as the prediction from the Sarita initial mass function. So now we have good statistics, and it seems to indicate that the initial mass function in this very low density, low star formation environment is actually the Sarita. There's no truncation. Very massive stars can still form in this environment. So I hope that I convinced you that just the standard IMF is fine in XUV disks, even though it's an extreme condition. The mode of star formation is the same. The IMF is stochastically filled, but not truncated. So that's the main conclusion. And then I wanted to show you some CO detection, but I think I ran out of time, so I should stop here.
Thank you. Maybe after question and discussions, we can go ahead with your CO map. Any question or comment? Feel free to use the chat, unmute yourself. Don't wait for.
Yeah, I have a question.
Please, Albert.
Yeah, there is a lot of spread in the per galaxy. Some of the brighter galaxies have much more H alpha than others. Did you look at that?
Yeah, that's right. So yes, if you look at this last column, then there's a huge scatter. So sometimes. I think you have a good point. So relatively small galaxies tends to have small ratio.
Yeah.
And massive galaxies tends to have larger ratio. Yeah. Statistically, it's very difficult to say either way for individual galaxies with this method. So all I can say is if you add all these nearby galaxies, then the ratio seems to point the standard initial mass function.
Yeah. Are you planning to do more galaxies?
No. So having these 10 galaxies took almost 10 nights of Subaru time. So I don't think we can expand that.
Okay. Thank you.
When you talk about the stochastic process, are you able to identify also which law? Which probability low? We eventually, well, I suppose some with a lot of skewness, right? A very skewed toward low.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is extremely simple. Just take the IMF as probability distribution function and randomly take, field.
Okay.
Yeah. Just random.
Okay.
But I think that's a very good point. If you think about this very carefully, then you encounter a lot of almost a philosophical or a very, very physical question. So let's say, for example, if you form very low mass cluster, like total mass of 100 solar mass, can you really make 100 solar mass star there? And probability point of view, yes, there's a very small chance that you can make it. But at the same time, once you make the first star, let's say one solar mass, then you cannot make hundreds of solar mass star anymore in this particular cluster, right? Mm-hmm. So the order of star formation actually matters when you think about how to fit the initial mass function. So that's something I didn't take into account. I just assumed that everything was random and the order doesn't matter. But if you think about this problem very carefully, then I think the scatter starts to matter. And that's something we want to take into account in the next analysis.
So you use the initial null function as the probability law and randomly draw points on that and not use it as a mean value and then on top of which defines some other laws. I mean, for instance, you can figure out some Gaussian or whatever probability function for every value of the mass given by the initial null function. See what I mean?
Yeah. So around each range, you assume.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
I don't know if it makes sense. I don't know. And totally.
Yeah. So when we do analysis, it may make sense. I have to think about it very carefully. So I think the question comes down to, do we need to differentiate 14 solar mass star versus 15 solar mass star? I mean, they may be the same. We may treat them as the same thing. So in that case, instead of delta function, we may assume Gaussian. But I need to think about it more carefully.
Thank you.
Can I make a question?
Please.
Thanks. A very nice talk. I mean, I'm happy to see that you got us more or less the same results we got with the integrated values for galaxies a few years ago. I just, on this stochasticity point, if I do remember well, there was a work of Michele Fumagalli who made a code which might even be available on the net. You could maybe try to use it and it can give you the probability that stochasticity is a problem or not there. I just had a question. Maybe you said that I missed. How do you correct for nitrogen 2? You might have a contamination of nitrogen 2 in the narrow band H alpha.
Yeah, so yeah, in this case, I just included it and I didn't try to separate them out. What I did was I included in the model. And because it's low metallicity, and if I assume constant metallicity there, then I can, you know, fix the ratio between H alpha and nitrogen 2 around. So I can just add those lines on top of the SED from SSP model and then measure the whole thing with Subaru filter. So I adjust the model side.
Yeah, okay. In any case, I think the contamination should be low. I mean, you are in low metallicity environment, it should be like something like 10% or.
Yes. And that also comes back to the one of the first point I made. If you look at the ionizing photon flux, it decreases an order of magnitude. So those factor of 2 doesn't really matter. Well, thank you very much. The contribution is very small, but we do take that into account on the model.
Okay, thanks.
Annie, you have a question, please.
Thank you. Thank you for the talk. I was wondering if you have any idea about the column density, the H2 column density in these outside regions, and if there is any relation with the star formation and possible detection with CO dark gas in this galaxy.
That's a very good question. And that's actually the second part of the talk. And I've been working on that here in LAM in the past 2 months. So I think there are some slides that I can show. And maybe we, after this Q&A, maybe we should close this and then I can continue if you are
interested. Okay. Thank you.
Any other question or comment? Well, if not, thank you, Yin, again. Your talk. I want to advertise next week Cafe Club. The speaker will be Rajeshwari Rutta from University of Milano Bicocca. She'll talk about the evolution of galaxies and their environment. This is the first announcement. And the second one is just to remind you that to the LAM people, you're kindly invited to propose speakers for the next year, starting from January. We can do also live at LAM if speakers are there. Otherwise, we'll continue with a remote-based seminar. Asking for people from all the institutes. So that's it. Thank you very much, Ian, again, and see you next week.